suppose, have we decided where we stand on Prokofiev yet? Is together or apart?
Well, apart, because I'm going to stand in favour of Woody Allen.
Well, the first thing is, how are you going to pronounce the first word? I presume you're in the lieutenant camp.
Oh, I'm definitely lieutenant. We're not. None of this American nonsense here.
Lieutenant or lieutenant. No, and I would be Lieutenant Kije.
Lieutenant Kije by Prokofiev, obviously, this evening. This is a suite again, but this time not stolen or reduced from a ballet, but from a film. So he was commissioned to do the music for the film. I listened to it last night, or I watched it last night.
You watched the film?
I watched the film last night.
That's a bit serious.
So the original 1937, for which he did the score before he transformed it into the work that it is today. Of course, everyone has stolen this, the basic underlying idea of the plot. George Orwell uses it in 1984. It's used in a myriad of ways because it's a French farce kind of idea. The idea is that a little accident is made in writing out the names of people who are going to be promoted. And they write out the phrase, you know, to be promoted. And that, in Russian at the time, when split up, looks or sounds a little like Lieutenant Kije. So this was either everyone below to be promoted or this man to be promoted. And so there's a mistake, and they invent this guy. So this invented guy becomes made a lieutenant by the Tsar, and Tsar Paul, and he makes him a lieutenant. And then because they're all sycophants around him, and the bureaucracy cannot be turned around, he exists. And then the Tsar inquires after him occasionally, how's he doing? And he promotes him here and there, and then he's charged with a crime of assaulting a woman, and he's beaten severely, but in fact they've no one to beat, so they just report that they've beaten him severely, and the army has to watch while a sort of a stick is beaten. But then later on the Tsar, he has a pang of conscience, and he brings him back from Siberia, where he's sent to, and he promotes him again, and he becomes a general. And this time, the Tsar is in real trouble, and he needs his friends around him. So he thinks about old Lieutenant Kije from the good old days. He says, bring him back, I need him beside me in St. Petersburg. So now the bureaucracy is pretty, pretty amazed. What will they do now? He's dead.
He's dead.
So then he has a state funeral, of course.
Perfect.
And then all through this, we have, that's what the music is. It's representing all of these sort of elements in the life of this individual. But of course, what it is a lovely attack on bureaucracy. But really, it seems like it's an attack on the bureaucracy of the Tsar. But people like Prokofiev, of course, are subtly using it to attack the bureaucracy of the Soviet regime. And this is where you get sort of this Citizen Smith invents a character in Orwell, who's this hero of the revolution that they promote all the way up, and then he dies and so forth. So Prokofiev, anti-Stalinist counter-agent, discuss.
And you were saying as well to us about stealing or borrowing, shall we say.
Yes.
The Troika part of it, of course, has been borrowed endlessly. And of course, I got to know Lieutenant Kije in reverse, you might say, because the first thing I knew was the Greg Lake, wasn't it?
That is it. It's Greg Lake. What was the name of that?
I Believe in Christmas.
I Believe in Christmas.
Yeah? 1974. That is 40 years ago, Thomas. We'll gloss over that as quickly as we can.
So obviously we heard it on its reissue, I think. And there was, yes, naturally. When it was put out on CD in about 1983, I think that's when we heard it. No, I'll go one worse and say that I know this in reverse as well from Woody Allen. That's why I'm saying Woody Allen. This is from Love and Death. And in Love and Death, they have the sleigh ride going through. Sleigh ride going through, and now he's going on the sleigh. And, of course, that's what it should be.
Was it a troika?
It was a troika. What is a troika, sir?
A three-horse sleigh. And it was like the express passenger service of its day. It could go really quickly. And they would change them, the horses, relay them quite frequently, as far as I know. And they could make a fairly good speed of it. But I think I've mentioned to you this before, Thomas, but a good friend of mine once labelled me a pop and rock illiterate. Accurately, I must say. But there was one sort of glaring omission there, is that in the early to mid-70s, I was a glam rock fan. I knew the Sweet Slade, Mud, whoever it was. If it was in the top 20, I knew it. So in other words, if it was almost talent-free, I knew it. I used to record the top 20 every Sunday evening. Remember? And then I'd record on a big reel-to-reel, you see? And then I'd play it all through the week and then record over that then the next week. Up three places, down, whatever. And this is how I got to know the Troika thing. And then when I came across Lieutenant Kijak, I was like a fool. I was thinking it had used the thing back up. It was the other way around, of course. And it's been used endlessly. And I'd say half the population of the world just think it's a piece of Christmas music.
Yeah, I mean, it just evokes snow. And so even here this evening, you know, we're thinking snow in the middle of all this. But what is it? That's in the film. Having seen the film last night, that's exactly what happens.
I'm not sure you should be broadcasting the fact that you stayed up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch this Soviet-era film, which was pretty boring, I believe.
Well, I think people will appreciate my effort, to get a completed round of thing. And my little insight, this tiny little insight. There was a tune, there was a song that went with it. So they're singing along with it, and I finally found the caption to turn on the subtitles in English. And the title is Roadside Inn, Roadside Inn. Like a woman's heart, always open. And this is the tune. That's the song for the Troika part of Prokofiev. Now, it didn't say, and I did rewind it several times, did Prokofiev in some way have anything to do with the words? But I don't think he did. But it really is astonishing. What's really amazing is how film can throw us in terms of this. So in terms of where we're pitching and where we're thinking of Prokofiev, Prokofiev gets pitched back in some people's minds, certainly mine instinctively, to the sort of 19th century sleigh-pulling troika, because that's the image we have it from later films, even including Woody Allen's Love and Death. But in fact, it's a 1937. It's a product of the 1930s and not a product of the 1830s. But it is an old-fashioned tune.
Well, perhaps, Tomas, you know, Prokofiev stood, I suppose, really with one foot in the old Tsarist imperial Russia and one foot in the grim Stalinist period. He was, I'm sure he must have harked back. He was maybe not quite aristocracy, but certainly up there. I'm sure he must have harked back for that. He left straight after the revolution, as you know, went to the States, got a little bit disillusioned. And funnily, I mean, I've no really understanding of why he went back to Russia, but possibly just homesickness more than anything else. So it's interesting to see. This is where we were talking earlier about, you know, where do we stand in Prokofiev. I would have a very high regard for him because I think he was so versatile. He could do pieces of music like this, which essentially are, you know, light and lissom, the classical symphonies. But I mean, imagine being a man, you know, very much of the 20th century in terms of, you know, his compositional period, being able to almost transpose his compositional effort back into the classical era, as we've heard, what was it, last week or the week before. I think that attests to the fact that he was remarkably talented, and he could write this light, lissom music as well as very serious stuff. Was he the greatest of the 20th century? Maybe not.
I definitely think not. I mean, I think, you know, you say versatility, I say changeable with the wind, you know. I say open to the highest bidder.
Trite, perhaps?
I won't even say trite. We won't go as far as trite, but he was a man who had all the principles of a betting ring. So whoever waved money at him, that's where he went.
Oh, you're being very harsh.
I'm being a little bit harsh. But so he was, in fact, he was driven back through financial circumstances back to the Soviet Union rather than through conviction. I'm sure there was obviously a desire to return to Mother Russia, of course, as well. But he departed the minute there was trouble. Yes, he was from a particular class that was outside of the class that was obviously leading the revolution. I think he's a technician. I don't feel soulfulness coming out of any of his works, and we've seen a few of them now over the season. They are really proficient and excellent, very, you know, wonderful, you know, rhythm, wonderful tunes. They'd pass the old grey whistle test, you know, a real tune.
Just let me take you back then, Tomas, because you made similar comments months ago, I think, yes, with regard to Mozart. Would you be somehow feeling of them in the same way, that they were perhaps brilliant artisans rather than artists?
No, I think I would definitely put Mozart in a different category, mm-hmm, of genius without any difficulty. And I think you look at the quality and range of work that Mozart produced, you look at his innovation in every single field he engaged in, and you're seeing somebody of a totally different character. I still think he's more of a technician than the romantic artist that we want in latter periods within classical music. However, Prokofiev now, you look at what he did after he came back to Russia, you know, and you find Peter and the Wolf. You find a lot of light, a lot of light populist work. Now, should we, you know, condemn light populist work, especially if you're turning up in a Soviet Republic of the People?
Well,
I don't think so, no.
Especially if you've got Stalin glaring over your shoulder.
But you didn't have to go back. You know, there were other places to stay. And if you look at what's going on, Samuel Barber now, look at Knoxville, 1915. And here's a way of being evocative in exactly the same way that we're expecting Lieutenant Kije to be evocative. And here's a way of doing it in a profoundly emotional, profoundly romantic, and I think, you know, significant way.
It's a lovely piece, isn't it?
Beautiful piece.
And it seems for, you know, it just seems to, I don't know, I don't think I've ever been to Tennessee, but it seems to evoke that whole thing. I can, as I listen to it, there's that sort of lilting, slightly solemn sound to it, and I can think of guys sitting out on the stoop on their veranda, you know, chewing tobacco or whatever, and maybe sipping a little bit of Tennessee whiskey, you know, which, strictly speaking, well, is it bourbon or not? Nobody
no,
seems
it
to
is,
know.
No, it is not bourbon. No, it is not bourbon.
And they absolutely do not label it as such, but in a strict definition, it's a, I think it's called a bourbon-style whiskey made in Tennessee or something like that, you know. And, of course, the best known of which is Jack Daniels, which Jack Daniels is fairly ho-hum as far as I'm concerned. Although, have you ever had the Jack Daniels, which comes in the sort of slightly squat bottle, the, what do they call it, the single barrel? It's really, it's well worth the premium. It goes way up the scale as far as I'm concerned. But I think this piece, the Knoxville piece, it just evokes that slightly, you know, a bit of a down at heel, I suppose, sort of thing, of a bit of maybe not quite Dust Bowl stuff, but certainly an element of that there.
Well, I mean, it's quite there is a lot of it in it. I have to say, I mean, what I think the programmer of tonight's pieces is saying to me is that Terrence Malick in The Tree of Life, when he's using Smetana and My Homeland to evoke this kind of southern, beautiful, melodious, honey-draped sun of a childhood, that basically Terrence Malick in The Tree of Life has stolen this from Samuel Barber's Knoxville 1915. And I'm pretty convinced. I would have to say I am saying guilty.
What you're really saying to us is that this program here tonight was put together with you in mind.
Well, I feel very much the focus of the attention. No.
You're not stretching it a bit there now.
I am stretching it too far. I think there is always in programming, and people don't, we don't think about it enough, and people who love attending the concert hall like ourselves, what we love is we love the way in which these things are programmed, and it's done in an intellectually engaging way. And I want to make sure that, you know, you and I both, we know that, we enjoy it and we love it. So that's all I'm saying.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
Thomas, I think the programming over the season has been very sensitively done. I mean, when you think of what's been, we can say, complain about a lot of things in this country here at the moment, but what's on offer here in the National Concert Hall, our National Concert Hall with our national orchestra usually playing, is a remarkably wide and varied cultural asset to the country. We've had Tchaikovsky, we've had Copland, we've had Bernstein, we've had all sorts of Prokofiev, Shostakovich, some fantastic performers, some fantastic performances. I think it's worth celebrating. There's so many things we want to knock, we want to, and I'm as bad as anyone in that respect, but it's worth celebrating something like this. And I don't feel that I have any position here as cheerleader or anything like that, much more along the commentator side of things, but really it's worth drawing attention to the fact.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, Prokofiev, we've had a wonderful, wonderful evening listening. And then you get to think about, you know, the Soviet Union and the nature of Tsarist Russia, you know, in the middle of all the stuff that's going on now. This is, you know, it brings it up to us. I mean, this piece by Samuel Barber is in Knoxville, Tennessee, 1915. This is based on a section from an autobiographical work by James Agee, the screenwriter of African Queen and Night as the Hunter, and it's about the death of his father. And that's, he again, when Samuel Barber was writing this, his father was dying. He was very ill all through the period that he was writing this, and he was extremely upset about it. And he had resonance from reading this short story or this chapter within the autobiography, and he produced this beautiful work. And here's where the programming comes in again. Dvorak now. We're looking at, you know, the 7th, good stuff, hardcore brilliance. And when's he writing this? He's writing this saddened by the death of Smetana, who has died and is profoundly depressed and upset, Dvorak. And so there is a connection with Smetana, and the person programming knows this and knows that that Smetana connection is going through to Malik, who's talking about Knoxville, Tennessee, where we have Samuel Barber. There's a profound brilliance to watching and listening to a symphony where you can see huge intellect going on in the composer and knowing that even within the program, that intellect is being reflected in this programming.
Detective Chief Inspector Clancy has found the link. If you think about the orchestra as we know it today, Tomas, like that multifaceted unit, I'm thinking of it as an instrument in itself. It's only about 200 years old. Prior to that, let's say, for instance, Mozart, or even going back further to Bach, those men were typically writing for the musicians at their disposal. The music wasn't perhaps going to travel all over the place. Whereas if you leap forward to Prokofiev, who spent most of his writing life was the first half of the 20th century, he knew. If he was writing a symphony in New York, or if he was writing a symphony in St. Petersburg, he knew it could be played anywhere. It could, you know, that score could be taken to New York or Chicago or Melbourne. And the resources there would be broadly similar to what he was writing for. So it began to straddle the globe then. And it was at that point as well, about 200 years ago, that the conductor became an integral part of the orchestra, because the orchestra was expanding, getting bigger. Instrumentation was better. I mean, you as a trumpeter would know yourself. The brass instruments were becoming much more sophisticated. Up until, take the French horn, for instance. That was just like the French hunting horn, you know, you'd wear over your shoulder. But then, of course, the vowels were added in, similarly on the trumpet. And the scope, the range that those instruments could play was increasing all the time. Our old pal Berlioz, who we were perhaps a little hard on a week or two ago, he made a significant study of orchestration, not just instrumentation, not just writing for an instrument within an orchestra, but orchestration, how you would get them to play together. And Dvorak was almost a beneficiary of Berlioz's study. And I think the Dvorak Symphony was very highly regarded at the time, as it continues to be highly regarded, because it seemed to be the summit of Dvorak's ability to use the resources available to him, particularly, I think, in the last movement. There's a depth and a breadth there in the last movement where the resources are now available, there's a big orchestra available, why not use it? And he really did very well there. And of course, I think the highest compliment paid to him at the time was that it was called Brahms' Fifth Symphony. Of course, Brahms was the towering figure. Brahms had a huge influence on Dvorak as mentor and supporter and so on and so forth. But Dvorak's symphony became known as his Fifth Symphony. If you go back further again, if you think of the symphonic links back, I love to see links over history, over the generations. Brahms's first symphony in its time had been known or called Beethoven's Tenth Symphony. So you see this link coming all the way through. And I think that must have given Dvorak an enormous lift. And of course, he was hugely popular and hugely, massively well regarded in his time. Immediately after he died, sort of faded away a bit. But there's no doubt that this piece, which I'm really looking forward to hearing, I've listened to it a couple of times, I'm really looking forward to this, because it seems to me to be almost a summit, not just for Dvorak, but in terms of look, we now have this great instrument called a big modern symphony orchestra. What can we do with it? Can we test it? How can we use it to its fullest?
Goodness, let's go and hear that instrument.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.